So, the Tenzo Kyokan. I will skip any kind of introduction and refer you to the first talk online, apart from to reiterate that Dogen is encouraging, in this work, Dogen's encouraging those. Okay, well, first, this is a work oriented toward monastic practice and is instructions for the cook in a monastery. And hopefully we won't get too worried about that and recognize that really he's talking about ways that we can bring practice into our working life, into our daily life. And one of the central themes of this is, kind of initiating themes, is the importance of making training a priority in our daily life, in our daily practice. In some sense, making it the center of our life. And that applies to monks, obviously in a kind of formal setting. But it also applies to lay trainees, lay practitioners in an informal setting. A monk in a monastery, or Master Jiu used to talk about the importance of not having a professional priesthood, a priesthood that is just concerned with the form of the practice and doing the service of all the weddings and funerals and all of that kind of stuff, all the formal services of a priest. We can get too kind of focused on that and miss the point of training our own minds. And when Dogen is talking about being an excellent priest, being an excellent monk, that's what he's talking about. Someone who is just willing to train their minds in whatever circumstance they find themselves in. So, excellent priests such as Tozon once held this office. It is important to understand that the Tenzo priest is utterly different from a royal cook or waiter. And we talked a little bit about this the last time, that he's not just there to be making food. He's there to be making food in a selfless way. He's there to embody training. He's there to give expression to training. And he's there to actually train himself. I often asked questions of the senior priests when I was undergoing my training in China. All of them were very kind in telling me what they knew of the duties of the cook, saying that they who were entrusted with this office were the very cream of Buddhism, as it has been handed down to us from the enlightened Buddhas and ancestors. If we would understand the duties of the cook, we must study the Zen temple regulations thoroughly, listening in the minutest detail to the explanations thereof given by seniors. So one of the aspects of practice, one of the aspects of it's essential to practice for all of us, is this idea of taking refuge. As I've mentioned before, I was a professional baker before I became a monk, and I have a great love of baking and honestly the business of bakeries and being a baker and all this stuff. So one day in the town where I was living, this bakery opened up and they had a wood-fired oven in the bakery. And they made artisan bread. And I went by that bakery just to check it out, see if I could talk to the baker there, and he happened to be there. And he said this interesting thing. He said, "Oh yeah, my main concern is that I give expression to my my vision of what bread is in my bakery. And he didn't want to talk to me. And I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. And I think he made pretty good bread that people in the town liked the bread. There can be this kind of notion in the modern society that to be a cook or a chef or a, in this person's case, a baker, you know, like the royal cook or waiter, is to give expression to some kind of essential selfness, some kind of, you know, my vision, my sense of the self. It can be a great expression of self-expression. And we, in some sense, glorify that in our modern world in many different ways. But the monastic cook is somewhat different in that they're interested in cooking as a way of being of service to the temple and to the beings who come there. And their interest is in letting go of the self and giving expression to what we might call the true self. What we might call Buddha nature. So the kind of vibe of that, the kind of what we give off when we have that as our orientation is quite different than the vibe, the what we give off from I want to give expression to my vision of what's good food or what the self is or what whatever it is, my artistic expression. So here Dogen is saying, the chief cook, he himself asked questions of the senior priest. He himself learned how to be a chief cook from those who had gone before him. Listening in the minutest detail to the explanations thereof given by seniors. Every 24 hours after lunch, the cook has a consultation with the treasurer and assistant director concerning the food to be used for the following breakfast and lunch. How much rice and the quantity and type of vegetables. Once the food has been prepared, it must be cared for in the same way as we care for our own eyesight. It was said by one Zen teacher that the common property of the temple must be accorded the same care as that accorded to our own eyes. This food must be dealt with as if it were for the royal table. Exactly the same care must be given to all food, whether raw or cooked. Once the food has been prepared, it must be cared for in the same way as we care for our own eyesight. It was said by one Zen teacher that the common property of the temple must be accorded the same care as that accorded to our own eyes. Having lived many years in a monastery, there's this interesting thing I've observed where and this is a kind of general problem. This points to a general problem of practice. Where we in letting go of the self, find ourselves between opposites. So when you go to live in a monastery, you have set aside having all your own stuff. And when you have all your own stuff, you take care of it in a certain way. It's your stuff and you want to take care of it. Either that or you don't take care of it. But it's your stuff and it's your decision to what to do about it. So you have certain habits around stuff. And those habits are based on your relationship to your stuff. When you go to the monastery, you might think, this isn't my stuff, so I can have a kind of indifference to it. I don't have to engage with it. I don't have to worry about it or deal with it. And that can mean, I worked in maintenance as part of my monastic training at Shasta Abbey, and so I was constantly going around trying to fix things. And you might be surprised, but monks are very, very hard on material things. Things are constantly being broken. And in part, I think it was due to, you know, just not in a selfish way, but just not knowing about the tools and things that people had to deal with. If you go to, I'm thinking about how many food processors we went through in the kitchen. We would get donated a food processor that was designed for someone's home use. And they were designed for just personal use, so not really for an industrial kitchen, which Chaste Abbey is pretty much an industrial kitchen in certain respects. Serving food for a lot of people under kind of challenging circumstances. So we get donated a food processor, and if you had that food processor at home, you'd study it and know how it works and know its weaknesses, its limitations, and be able to kind of work with that and get to know it over time and make it last. But you have 10 different people using that food processor, each in some state of being in a hurry, and pretty quick that food processor is busted. Just again, not because of self, but because you just don't have the kind of same relationship to stuff. So in some sense, over time, I had to like think to myself, how do I care for the things of the monastery as if they were my own, but also let go of any kind of sense of the proprietary about them? Like, oh, this is my food processor, you know, I know how to use it, and not let someone else use it, or something like that. You see what I'm getting at? So there's a place that we find right in the center where we learn how to care for what's around us, care for the common property, in a way that we might have invested in our own personal stuff, but without the sense of propriety about it, without the "it's mine." This is kind of an interesting thing here in this temple for me. People often, particularly little kids, will say, "Is this your house?" And I have to explain, no, this isn't my house, even though I live here. I really only have a room that's back there in the corner. And I have to care for the temple as if, well, I have to just care for the temple as if it were my house. But it's not my house. And I have to be really quite clear about that. Not my space, in order to make it neutral and inviting to whoever comes. I can't just nest here in a certain way and make it give off the sense of that's Reverend Leon's house. Every 24 hours after lunch, the cook has a consultation with the treasurer and assistant director concerning the food to be used for the following breakfast and lunch. How much rice and the quantity, the type of vegetables. Once the food has been prepared, it must be cared for in the same way as we care for our own eyesight. It has been said that one Zen teacher, yes, I read that already. In Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi, there's this great line. I'm going to talk a bit more about this thing. If you should go against the basic truth, you come to a dead end. This is as if a giant fireball. Never come too close, nor put yourself too far away. If you express by fancy words, it is all stained. Urban Master Jiu paraphrases that at one point as, never come too close or put yourself too far away from anything. There was a we give expression to the self in various ways, sort of unwittingly, unknowingly. And Once when I was having a Dharma discussion with some people, and a person came in late, and they, out of respect, were trying to be quiet. But they came in and made no noise, physical noise. But if you've ever seen a mime, kind of miming walking, but walking very quietly, trying to make it seem like they weren't there. Of course, the mime's job is to focus the attention of the audience on the mime. So if they're pretending to be quiet and walking in a very slow, careful way, they are basically calling attention to themselves. And mimes, if you've ever seen a good one, play off that in a kind of fun way. So this woman, as she walks into the room, she's walking as if she were a mime, kind of saying, "Don't look at me, I'm not here." And everybody, the conversation stopped and everybody in the room turned and looked at her. It was as if she had sent up a little flag that said, "No, really, I'm not here, don't look at me." Although that wasn't her intention. Her intention was just to say, "I'm being quiet." We unwittingly give expression to this in various ways. And so the matter of taking refuge with the seniors and the other officers of the temple is a way of helping us to find our way to letting go of how we call attention to ourselves in various ways. If I'm all kind of caught up in how wonderful my cooking is, if I'm all caught up in how excellent and how everybody's going to like my food, and I have to take refuge with my fellow seniors, oftentimes that process will probably be a little bit painful, because they're going to probably not even overtly or deliberately, although sometimes maybe deliberately, inevitably there's going to be some little pin put in our bubble of self-importance. Equally, if we're being too kind of frightened and reserved and not doing our job fully, there's a kind of safety in protecting the self, being too shy and not assertive enough in the kitchen. If we're taking refuge with our fellow seniors, our fellow monks, they're gonna put a pin in that one too. They're gonna say, "You need to be more active. You need to be more forward." When I worked in the Shasta Abbey kitchen as a novice, the monk who was the chief cook at the time had been the chief cook 15 years and or so, and he completely inhabited the job, he completely inhabited the kitchen, but it was not in a selfish way, it was not in a way that it was calling out to say, "Look at me." It was just completely inhabiting the job in a wholehearted way. And you had to, I'm pretty sure there was a rule about not running in the monastery. After morning service, you had to make every haste to get to the kitchen without spending any extra time doing anything. Short of running, you had to get there very quickly. And then from the moment you stepped in the door, it was like getting onto a speeding bus, kind of getting the work done. There was no it was just a full-bodied experience. And so working in the kitchen there and working in other kitchens before and taught me that we bring mindfulness to whatever kind of activity that we're doing. we don't necessarily have to conform the activity to some ideal of how mindfulness should be. I hope that makes some sense. So, in the midst of our full-bodied work in the kitchen, it was essential that I be mindful for my own kind of sanity and, of course, for my own training. But that didn't mean that I got to be all slow and careful and like that mime kind of going one thing at a time. We just would cook. There's a saying in Zen, you know, when you're hungry, eat, when you're tired, sleep. And we just live, we just do what needs to be done in a wholehearted way without giving expression to that thing. Here I am, I'm the self being mindful. Here I am, I'm the self being whatever it is, you fill in the blank. And so, again, the whole experience of being the cook is being the cook in a community, and that community is helping us to see our own self in some sense. In the daily life of our own kind of existence, apart from a sangha that's actively training in some sense, we get cues from our environment all the time that's kind of telling us one way or the other. Am I being too assertive a self? Am I being too little a self? How can I let go of the self? And we're getting constant cues about that. Let's see if I can think of a... So, and part of that is the kind of consultation that we would take in our work life. We would be working with others, talking to others, soliciting their feedback, and, you know, listening to how our interactions go, just paying attention. If we're too absorbed in our own thing, then we get that feedback eventually. But we can also think, how can I not be so absorbed in my own thing? Or if we're too sensitive to what other people think, that tends to be my direction, how can I not do that? How can I be more independent-minded, more assertive kitchen? At a certain point when I first started working the kitchen, I was all afraid, and when I was a professional cook, I just dropped out of college, I was scared, was working with these guys who are pretty rough. But one day my boss came to me and he said, we want you to become a power in the kitchen. and I thought, what? That's kind of ridiculous. So one day, I thought about that for a while, and then one day, these two big guys were there having a fight about who was going to be the wheelman on the brunch morning, and brunch is kind of, you know, on the horizon, where it's going to be a disaster if somebody doesn't take the job. So I step up and say, okay, I'm going to be the wheelman. You do the walks, you do the eggs, and this is the way it's going to be today. They both kind of said, oh, okay. Stopped fighting and got to work. So what I'm trying to say is that in various ways, positive or negative, we will get encouragement from our environment about how we can be assertive. And it is our job then as trainees to find practice within that. After the above-mentioned consultation, another is held in the temple kitchen for the purpose of deciding which vegetables shall be eaten, which tastes relished, and what gruel made. The Zen temple regulations state clearly that, when food is prepared, the cook must consult with all the officers. The treasurer, assistant director, guest master, disciplinarian, and general maintenance personnel. As to what tastes shall be relished at breakfast and lunch and the number of vegetables to be used. When the above matters have been decided, the menu for the day is written upon the boards which are hung in front of the abbot's room and the trainees' hall. Thereafter, the following morning's breakfast gruel is cooked. As we go along and look at this work, he's going to have a fair number of details about how the kitchen should be run and what the cook should do. Reverend Master Jiu was once talking about, I think something came up with, somebody was criticizing her, maybe when she was in Impukiji in Japan, about having a new toilet. And the criticism was, well, this isn't how Dogen did it. This isn't how Dogen had his temple set up. And you can read in Dogen, Dogen has a chapter of the Shobogenzo about rules for the bathhouse, the bathroom, basically. And Reverend Master Jiu was saying, the thing about Dogen's rules for the bathhouse, the bathroom, was he was introducing in those rules the most current hygiene from China that were known in the world at that time. He was introducing very cutting-edge hygiene into the monastery regulations. We look back on it with nostalgia and think he was talking about a particular thing, but his intention was actually to introduce the best regulations that he could for the health of his community. So having a new toilet seemed quite in accord with Dogen's actual intentions, if you see what I'm getting at. Dogen lays out the details of the form in here, and wherever we are, we need to understand that there is some kind of form that we can follow, the form, the procedures of our job, whatever they are. Those procedures and forms will shift and change. When you go to Shasta Abbey, which I think is actually pretty close to how Dogen's monasteries might have run, it's slightly different. The consultation that you have is mostly with the abbot, although there's a strong relationship between the kitchen and the treasurer, the bursar's office, and the sacristy about how the ceremonies are going to go. So there's consultation, but it may not be specifically according to the form that Dogen describes in here. But there is a point, again, neither put yourself too far away nor too close to anything. There is a point to understanding that the form that we encounter in our own life is something worth paying attention to. Not from a point of view of holding on to it, not where we make it into another kind of self, but just from the point of view of harmony in our community, harmony in our own internal life, and the letting go of the self as we go along within our daily practice. So I think that's what I have to say. For today. Any thoughts or comments or questions about that or about anything else?
What is meant by care for the food as you do your eyes?
Yeah. We can have a kind of we can have various kinds of reactions to things in the world, whether it's food or anything else. We can have a kind of contempt for things that are not so good, or we can have an excessively exalted view of food that is special. What I think Dogen is trying to get at here is, particularly in a Zen temple, well, like at Chest Abbey, we used to, it was for many years quite poor and was always and still does have a concern for not wasting food. So when I was working the kitchen, I would often have the job of going into the local produce company. They would call us up and say, we have some food to come and fetch, and I would go in and get the food, and it would often be food that they weren't able to sell anymore, and it was starting to, oftentimes, you know, vegetables decompose and whatnot. And so I would go in with our 3/4-ton pickup and fill up the back of it with food, and I would bring it home, and we would spend a good amount of time sorting through that food and getting out what was usable and composting the rest of it. Oftentimes it might be a quarter of the food that we would that I would fetch that we would turn into eatable food. But it was quite helpful to us because we didn't have that much money. And it was also good practice for learning how to not have contempt for the food of less quality. When one of Dogen's, so on the level of the food, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about having neither contempt for nor excessive exaltation for the quality of food that comes in. In terms of our eyesight, there is a place, in terms of meditation, one of Dogen's central ideas is the dropping off of body and mind, letting go of body and mind. We emphasize, in some sense, in a daily way, the letting go of what goes on in the mind. But we also need to, at some point, engage with the idea of letting go of the body, letting go of our excessive concern for the body or our excessive exaltation of the body and how it functions. And this goes to that point of neither put yourself too far away nor too close from anything. We sit still in the midst of our body and mind and allow things to arise and pass away. And we engage in, we interact with, shall I put it like that? Yeah, more like we're still in the midst of the functioning of our six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Yeah. And so within our eyesight, when we are sitting still within the sensor field of eyesight, we're neither getting too, going out into what we're doing with our eyes, what we're seeing. We're not neither going out and getting all fascinated in it, nor are we trying to block, go within too far and block off what's coming in to our eyesight, or just sitting still as if, and in some of the scriptures they talk about the sense gates, and the eye is a sense gate, and so we just sit still right at that gate and allow what is there to come in and go out, and there needs to be a kind of letting go in that. So when we care for our eyesight, we are seeing it fully, clearly, for the value that it is. It's really important. It makes us function, it helps us to function in the world. It's just quite important for functioning in the world. But we can't, we do ourselves a disservice if we overemphasize that sense faculty, because eventually, like all our sense faculties, it will fail. And so we care for it in the sense of being careful of it, taking good care of it, and accepting it for what it is, both its value, but also for its ephemeral quality. It will eventually fail, and we let go within it. So that's partly what he's getting at when we care for the food as if we care for our eyesight. Maybe say something a little bit more about self, this kind of notion of self-consciousness. And it's very hard to describe and a little bit difficult to do, particularly once you have self-consciousness arise. It's like when you walk down the street and you see somebody who you want to impress, and you suddenly have this kind of self-conscious kind of view of yourself, like, oh, do I look okay, kind of thing. And with our sense faculties, as we're sitting or just functioning, in our normal kind of natural state of being, they're just functioning. They're just functioning in an unimpeded way. But when we become kind of self-conscious of our eyesight, for instance, then it starts to be all funny, like, oh, what do I do now? And in one sense, we may have a tendency to be self-conscious even though we're not necessarily aware of it. So over time with practice, as we just begin to sit still, we may become aware of how we are selfish in that sense, in that sort of self-conscious kind of way, and begin to just drop that and let it go. And in terms of meditation, I'm describing the priest who was the chief cook. He functioned in this kind of unimpeded way. He was careful, mindful, but quite vigorous, quite active, and functioned in a kind of as if he were not impeded by anything within his own mind. And in some sense, we can learn how to do that as well. Okay. Satisfactory? Okay, well, thank you for coming and pleasure to sit with y'all.